Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. Chief Justice Annette Kingston, sir, is presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It's nice to have you all here. We have a healthy dose of students here today, so I'd like to acknowledge your presence. We have Port Washington High School. If you could stand, please. Great to see you. Go ahead and have a seat. Mount Horeb High School. And nice to see you. Welcome to the court. Finally, the interns from Governor Evers' office. Great. Wonderful to see you. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Go ahead and have a seat. So we have a busy courtroom today. We have oral arguments, and then we will have bar admissions, and then you're welcome to come back, and Justice Protasevich will speak with you today. I think the students, you're welcome anytime, but at noon is when she's planning on greeting you again in the courtroom. So we look forward to seeing you if you have time in your schedules to come back and listen to a justice talk about our jobs a little bit. All right. With respect to the case that we're hearing today, it's 24 AP 351, Wisconsin Elections Commission versus Devin Lemahue. Appearances, please. All right. So, good morning. I have on here, I think it's opposite. I think you're going to kick it off with 25 minutes of argument, followed by 30 minutes, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that correct? Perfect. All right. With that, let's get started.
Thank you, Your Honor. Every 4 years, the Wisconsin Election Commission must appoint an administrator for the Senate's consideration. But here, three commissioners have decided that they will not send any administrative appointment to the Senate for as long as they wish, effectively keeping the administrator in her position.
Is that in the record? I didn't read anywhere in the record where it said that there were three administrators who would not ever appoint a new administrator.
Well,
in this one instance they didn't, but can you point me where it says that?
Appendix 48, which is R21-17, Commissioner Thompson, one of the abstaining commissioners, said that WEC would not send any appointment over unless legislature, quote, promised to confirm, and that, quote, without such a promise, WEC should not even play this game. I think that sentiment was echoed by Commissioner Jacobs as well. I grant that the third commissioner did not say that, but I think it's fair from at least two of the three to surmise that their position is that they will never send an administrator over to the Senate unless the Senate promises to confirm them, which is, of course, not the purpose and design of advice and consent, to say we're not going to do it unless you pre-commit to rubber stamping what we're doing.
So, counsel, I guess my question for you is, didn't the legislature just come before the Supreme Court a few years ago and ask the court and argue that the expiration of a term virtually means nothing? How come you're back here now asking us to say that this time the expiration of a term actually means something? What's the difference?
Your Honor, in praying what the legislative position was that until a replacement has been confirmed, the existing office holder is a lawful holdover. We agree that Administrator Wolf is the lawful holdover currently. She can continue to exercise all the authorities of the administrator. This case raises a different question, which is under this particular statute, 1561.1b.1, whether the commission has to send over a confirmation for the Senate's consideration, which was not an issue at play in Prehn.
Are you asking us to overrule Prehn?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. In fact, one of the claims that that my friends brought in this case was to get the circuit court to rule that Administrator Wolf is currently a lawful holdover. We conceded to that point. We did not dispute it, so we certainly do not contest that aspect of the case. The issue is, she's a holdover. How do we get to the point where there is not a holdover, but a confirmed individual? And what the statute provides, and it's important to look at the statutory text, it has two features that I think settle the statutory question here. And this is the first sentence of 1561.1b1. First, it says that the administrator shall be appointed by a majority of the commission for the advice and consent of the Senate. The word shall is, of course, mandatory. But second, and also importantly, it says, it makes clear that that appointment lasts for 4 years, expiring on the 1st of July, the odd number year.
Well, in Prehn, it said 6 years.
Sorry, Your Honor?
In Prehn, it said 6 years.
Yes, Your Honor, and we do not dispute that Administrator Wolf is currently the lawful holdover. If in Prehn, the governor had, in fact, discharged his duty to nominate somebody to replace Prehn. Now, that person had not, at least at the point of the Prehn case, met with the approval of the Senate, and then you had a standoff between the governor, elected chief executive officer of Wisconsin, and the Senate. Here, the WEC, or three commissioners of the WEC, have not done the job that the governor had done in Prehn by nominating anybody. And our point is they just have to nominate. If they nominate, and
let's look at that language. I don't see shall nominate, but okay, the language says shall be appointed by a majority of the members of the commission with the advice and consent of the Senate, and then it says how long the term is, to a 4-year term. So you're trying to argue to us today that shall imposes an affirmative duty to do something by a certain time.
I think that is the best reading of the statutory text.
So let's talk about, and you get that from shall. So let's talk about some other situations. So when we have a constitutional provision in the U.S. Constitution, for example, that says the president shall be at least 35 years of age. So is that an affirmative duty of some kind? And if so, who has that duty?
Your Honor, not every use of the word shall in every context imposes an affirmative duty. In that context, that provides the age minimum that the president has to be in order to serve as president. That's not an action-forcing situation.
Okay, and so let's look at a different one. The Supreme Court shall have 7 members who shall be known as justices of the Supreme Court. This is the Wisconsin Constitution. So is that a duty on someone to make sure there's always 7? And if there's not, are we not a Supreme Court?
No, Your Honor. I think that is similar, or maybe perhaps identical, to the 35-year provision that you read for the U.S. Constitution, which is that establishes the mandatory rule for the body.
Okay, and I heard you say just before then that somehow shall is to nominate, but it doesn't say that, correct?
Your Honor, that's right. They were saying the actual term is shall be appointed by a majority of members of the commission with the advice and consent of the Senate.
Okay,
and they have not.
So does the Senate have a duty then? Because they shall be nominated with the advice and consent of the Senate. So are you saying that the Senate would have to also participate in the process?
Yes, to participate in the process of giving advice and consent.
Okay, yeah. So like in Prehn, when they didn't even hold a vote on it, so they would have to hold a vote on it? Is that what you're saying?
Obviously this wasn't briefed in this case. My understanding of the original public meaning of the concept of advice and consent is that it allows the body, the Senate usually, whether it's the United States Senate or here, to establish the procedures by which it will provide the advice and consent. The amount of time that the Senate takes to act on that, the internal procedures that the Senate decides to do that, I think that would be a non-justiciable issue that is committed entirely to the constitutional body of the Senate.
So they wouldn't have to bring it for advice and consent. So you think this statute just gives shall be appointed when it's describing the WEC administrator is only applies to the commission?
Well, the Senate has to discharge advice and consent. If Your Honor is saying that if the Senate doesn't discharge its advice and consent constitutionally, if it takes a certain amount of time, that can be litigated in another case. You know, I'm pretty sure I would be arguing here that whether that was a certain amount of delay was constitutional or not is an issue that is committed entirely to the Senate's discretion, but the court could decide differently. But here we haven't had an argument like that. So here the question is, can three commissioners essentially cut the Senate out entirely forever of the decision?
Under your reason, the way I'm hearing you when you're talking to Justice Dallet and speaking about the Senate, it says the Elections Commission shall be under the direction and supervision of an administrator, who shall be appointed by a majority of the members of the commission with advice and consent of the Senate to serve for a four-year term expiring on July 1st of the odd number year. Are you also saying then that four-year term shall be served out so that whoever is appointed the commissioner must serve for 4 years? Because that is the only way to logically read this sentence the way you are telling us to.
Well, the other issue of how a vacancy can be created is addressed by the subsequent sentence.
No. I'm talking about how you are using the word shall in this sentence. Well, you are saying that shall means that the majority of the commissioners must appoint a majority of the must appoint the administrator. You're saying that shall means that the Senate has this advice and consent that they must exercise. So then why wouldn't it go to the third phrase in that sentence, which says that the commissioner shall serve for a four-year term? That they have to, no matter what happens, they got to serve 4 years.
Because there's other provisions both in 1561(1)(b)(1) and also in other places of the Wisconsin Code that provide that vacancies can be created in certain ways. And because those are provided in certain ways, obviously the individual can resign. They could take another office where they can't serve in this position. They could pass away. So certainly that sentence, when you're talking about other issues, rise could not be looked at in isolation.
Aren't you really just asking, you're really asking us to read this sentence to give some kind of deadline by which the governor has to do this? Because I don't think anyone here would disagree that it's the governor that it's the commission. No one here would disagree that the commission is the one who makes the appointment. That's not up for grabs here. You're reading to us of this word shall in this sentence is to somehow tie it to a duty. And as I talked about earlier, shall doesn't necessarily impose an affirmative duty. I think you actually agreed that it doesn't always do that. But you're also saying it's a duty by a certain time. Because even if the commission has to do it, you're saying they have to do it at the end of the term. Because they did do it here. They did do it because that's how she got where she is.
Our position is not that they would have to appoint on like July 1st or June 30th or July 2nd. It's that just like I think they have a footnote right at the end of their brief that said even under a position, they should have a reason. The WEC commissioner should have a reasonable time to do it. And if Your Honors hold that there is a mandatory duty, and we're not going to exactly say where the line is, you know, maybe a week, maybe a month. It's now been a year and a half.
But why does it matter? I mean, why does it matter? Where do you get that there's a duty to do by a certain time? Where does that sentence say that?
Certainly, our argument is that if you pair the mandatory language of shall with the time frame for how long the office lasts, by far the most reasonable reading of that text is when that term expires, that's when that mandatory duty is performed. And by the way, I know we've had a lot of discussion here about hypotheticals and other use of shall. I don't read my friend's brief to dispute that if sentence used the active voice rather than the passive voice, that rather than saying shall be appointed by the commission, if the sentence was rather said the commissioners shall appoint.
Well, it certainly is clearer in the third sentence where it says if a vacancy occurs in the administrator position, the commission shall appoint a new administrator and submit the appointment for Senate confirmation no later than 45 days after the date of the vacancy. I can't imagine having a case over that sentence because that is crystal clear.
Well, certainly under the different understandings of shall and other hypotheticals that I've had mentioned earlier, that potentially wouldn't settle those hypotheticals. My point here is that the use of the active voice in that later sentence versus the passive voice in the first sentence doesn't make a meaningful difference. Brian Gardner, who I think is seen as the lead grammarian in the United States with regard to statutory interpretation, said all that has said that, and we say this in a brief, that all the use of the passive voice does is focus the mind of the reader on the thing acted upon, here the appointment of the administrator. So the only difference between the first sentence and the third sentence is the use of the passive voice.
No, what about the use of the word if? If a vacancy occurs.
Right, or 45
then,
days.
Right, if, then, and no, what about the no later than 45 days after the vacancy? That seems to impose a mandatory duty.
Well,
that doesn't say that in the first sentence.
And we're not arguing that the WEC had to act within 45 days. We're saying there's a mandatory duty in the word shall, and they had to do it within a reasonable time.
Okay, so you're saying reasonable time, and you're saying, what, they had to nominate? What if they don't agree? What if they're 3-3? Like, what are you saying that their duty was here?
Well, so certainly it happens sometimes in state government that a public official or body doesn't do a mandatory duty. Mandamus is the statutory tool to force that. If WEC wouldn't refuse to do its mandatory duty, a tool which is the one we used here of mandamus is the way that you solve that function.
And why do you think it's a plain duty?
Because of the statutory text. You know, obviously we have a disagreement here about the statutory text, but if the court agrees with us that we are correct in the statutory text, the plain duty comes from the statutory text.
Counsel, 2 years ago, three of my colleagues dissented from the Prain decision. They said the majority's absurd holding allows Prain's 6-year term on the Board of Natural Resources, which expired over a year ago, to last for as long as Prain wants it to, so long as he refuses to leave and the Senate doesn't confirm a nominated successor. Why haven't you asked us to adopt the dissent in that case, because that would get you the outcome you're seeking, right? And I go back to the dissent again. It said the majority bases these nonsensical conclusions on its misguided reading of a handful of statutes and a common law doctrine de facto de jure appointment.
Well, Your Honor, we certainly agree with the majority decision in Prain, but what is happening here is far more absurd, to borrow the term, that was going on there. There we had a constitutional standoff
far
between the governor.
Far more absurd assumes a fact that the first is absurd.
Well,
you don't mean it that
well,
way.
You know, whatever level of absurdity one wants to put on the Prain situation, whether it's 0 or 100, this one is orders of magnitude more. There you had a traditional constitutional standoff between the governor and the Senate. They didn't agree with the appointment. That's resolved in a holdover. Here we have three essentially bureaucrats who have no constitutional status holding the chief election officer appointment hostage away from the people. This is night and day from Prain. And these folks are saying that they're not going to send it over unless the constitutional body pre-commits to confirming their pick.
Did you just say that she's being held hostage?
The nomination.
The nomination
is being
not the nominee.
Is being held hostage away from the and they're saying I know that they're given the terms to release the hostage. You Senate pre-commit to confirm our choice, or we're not playing your game, and the game being advice and consent.
Let's talk about the game. I mean, you are trying to thread a needle here that has no eye. 6 of the 7 of us sat in this courtroom 2 years ago when your client insisted that Fred Prain should be able to retain his position on the DNR board even though his 6-year term had expired. And your client won. This is a case of careful what you wish for, isn't it? And now the legislature is here 2 years later demanding that Megan Wolf must vacate her position. It seems to me this has little to do with what the law actually says and far more to do with who is in these positions. If the legislature favors someone, they stay. If they don't, they must go. Does that sound like the rule of law to you?
If Megan Wolf was nominated, was appointed by the commission and sent over to the Senate, and the Senate acted the same way they did with Prain, which is not hold hearings, then Megan Wolf would stay as a holdover, exactly like Prain did. We are saying, we are asking for the same rule for Megan Wolf as Prain. And I would hate it if it was the opposite, that three members of WEC could essentially keep this appointment away from the people's representatives.
I think it's just the opposite. Don't you think it's a little fishy that the three Republican members of the commission, those three commissioners, voted to approve her and appoint her to send it to the Republican legislature, which is obviously going to debunk her? Doesn't it seem a little strange?
I don't think it's strange for commissioners who approve of a job that the administrator is doing and want her to continue in that job, will follow their statutory and constitutional responsibility to say, this is the person we want as the administrator of WEC. What is fishy, and not actually fishy because you don't have to guess what they were up to, is that the three...
Well, you can kind of tell what they were up to. It's pretty obvious.
And it's also obvious what the Democratic commissioners were up to, too, right?
It's clearly what the Democrat commissioners were up to.
If we follow that logic.
I think Justice Porter said, which if you look at the public statements of the Republican commissioners that voted for Administrator Wolf.
Well, I looked at some of the public statements of your clients, which seem to contradict the admissions that you made to the complaint of WEC and Ms. Wolf.
Well, Your Honor, may I just finish responding to your first
you
point?
May.
If you look at the public comments that were made by the Republican WEC commissioners that voted for Administrator Wolf, they were expressing confidence in her actions. They were recommending that she be, in fact, approved by the Senate.
Is this in the record?
I believe it was in the public, judicially noticeable record of the official proceedings of WEC. Now, certainly we put the statements of Mark Thompson, and that's in the appendix. The other statements, they're available in the public record in this court.
I think my colleagues are being a little unfair because they're asking you questions, you're responding, and then they're challenging, well, is that in the record? But the bottom line is that whatever the political strategies are of the commissioners, if there are any, is really irrelevant to the statutory interpretation that we are tasked with in this case. Is that right, counsel?
That's right, Your Honor. Although I will say that sometimes, we get into these separation of powers arguments before your court, and we parties put before you hypotheticals like this strategy could be used in this way that would really break the separation of powers. And sometimes you get pushed back, well, that's kind of hypothetical. But this wolf comes as a wolf. Commissioner Thompson said, we are not going to send anybody over unless the Senate pre-commits to approving them. That breaks the entire system. That is claiming, frankly, to use your term, an absurd loophole that essentially keeps the people's representatives from ever having a voice, at least after the first vote 4 years before, of who's going to serve as the chief election officer of the state.
Counsel, I wanted to just make sure I understand what you're arguing and what you're not. Some of your briefing talks about separation of powers. I took that to mean a reference to the statute, not a constitutional argument, at least by the reply brief. I think it was clear to me that you were not making, and I didn't see any fully developed constitutional separation of powers argument. That what I understood you to be arguing was really directing our attention to the statute, statutory language, and what it requires. And I just want to make sure that I'm not missing something with your argument. Is that correct?
It's true that we're not making a standalone, a non-statutory constitutional argument. Of course, the statute is enacted under the constitutional authority of the legislature.
Yeah. Maybe another way to say it, is just to make sure I understand, if this court disagreed with your interpretation of the statute, there isn't an alternative argument you're making to sustain your position. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, because if the statute means what my friends on the other side mean, that means the legislature is exercising its constitutional authority to create this,
right,
frankly, absurd loophole where three commissioners can hold a nomination hostage for as long as they want. We think that that's not clearly not what the legislature intended by the plain statutory text and the context. And what we have here today is the greatest illustration of how the legislature couldn't have possibly intended that.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Of course.
Counsel, in your briefing, but I point to the reply brief, you indicate that really whether or not there's a vacancy is irrelevant. Is that correct? Am I misstating that? Let me show you. Let me read what I think says that. And I'm looking at page 5, the heading, in your reply brief. Well, let me ask, regardless of what it says in your reply brief, do you think whether or not there's a vacancy is not essential to the argument?
Well, there's no dispute that there is no vacancy. So it's not that it's not essential. It's just that there's no dispute. There's no vacancy. She's a holdover until this is resolved.
Let me get to then the wording, which is on page 5 in your reply brief, the heading, which is subsection. Are you there yet? I don't want to go ahead of you. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm looking at it. It's, yeah.
Good. Subsection 15.611(b)(1) requires WEC to appoint an administrator at the expiration of each four-year term, even without a vacancy. And then on page 6, you state, shall at the top of the page, that 15.611(b)(1), quote, shall be appointed, quote, language itself confers appointment power upon WEC with no requirement of a vacancy. So
that's right.
I took that to mean that your argument is based on the first sentence of the text of that statute, regardless if there's a vacancy. Am I missing something?
That's correct. And I mean, it will usually arise when there is no vacancy. I mean, the third, fourth, and fifth sentences of that section explain what happens when there isn't vacancy. This is a more mundane scenario where the administrator serves out her full four-year term, and then WEC needs to appoint, either reappoint her to serve out another four-year term, or appoint somebody else for the advice and consent of the Senate.
Just to tie it up, the shall be appointed language, your argument is, by its very text, confers appointment power upon WEC, and there is no requirement of a vacancy. In other words, it could be non-vacant. Hmm?
That's right. And I don't think it'd take my friends to disagree with that position.
Just to follow up on that, three of the commissioners, though, did. I mean, the three commissioners who abstained seemed to indicate that they could not, they argued they could not vote to appoint Ms. Wolf because they didn't have power because there was no vacancy. And I think you're saying both parties disagree with that. Is that correct?
I don't think that they were saying that they didn't have the power to. In fact, Commissioner Thompson said clearly that if the Senate had pre-committed to confirming Ms. Administrator Wolf, he would have voted to reappoint her, and I think the rest of them would have too. And that is, I think, what's really good. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that what was going on here is the three commissioners who voted to abstain strongly support her staying on, and they won't vote for her unless the Senate essentially abdicates its role by pre-committing to confirm her.
Thank you.
Definitely not that way. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this is a holdover case, and appellants have conceded two of the core issues in this case already, that Megan Wolf is validly holding over as the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and that during that holdover, there is no vacancy for the commission to fill. The commission brought this suit after the Senate majority voted to deem her renominated and then voted to fire her. But in the litigation, appellants have quickly conceded those two points. And although their public comments, as Justice Protasiewicz referred to, have sometimes contradicted those litigation positions, they've never disputed in this case that she's validly holding over and that there's no vacancy in the position while she does so. Now let's move to the appellant's remaining argument that despite the holdover and despite the lack of vacancy, the commission has a duty, and a mandatory one at that, to reappoint her or to select someone new. That's wrong for two basic reasons: the plain language of 1561 itself and this court's decision in Pasco v. City, Milwaukee. So 1561 is a big statute that discusses appointments, removals, and vacancies both for members of the Wisconsin Elections Commission itself and for the administrator.
Counsel, I just want to follow up on the question I asked your opposing counsel, but I'm looking at the record here, and I want to make sure I'm understanding it, but in at least the appendix here, I think this was the maybe complaint, but Mark Thompson agreed and concluded the commission lacked even the ability under the current law to reappoint because there is no vacancy in the administrator position. So I thought, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, that the three Democratic appointees, or at least Commissioner Thompson, maybe others, voted present, at least they said they voted present, because they did not feel like they had the authority to even appoint a new administrator. And I see the position you're taking is, though you disagree that duty is mandatory upon the expiration of a term, but that you think that the commission, in fact, does have the authority to appoint a new administrator right now and that they were incorrect. Is that accurate?
Well, three answers to that. First of all, factually, Your Honor is absolutely correct that was the stated reason of the three commissioners. The side comment by Commissioner Thompson about we should have a deal in place, that was not joined by anybody else.
Yeah.
So Mr. Satan was a little confused on the record there. The question of whether they can appoint versus must or cannot is not an issue in this case because it doesn't matter whether they could and decided not to or whether they can't. Either way, they don't have a duty. The only issue in this case is whether they have a duty, and we're going to talk about why they don't. But I think the confusion comes from the discussion in Preen about, well, what can the governor do when there's a holdover and there's no vacancy for him to fill? And obviously the majority and the dissent had different views of 15.07.
It would be pretty hard for us, I think, to decide this question as a matter of statutory interpretation and not at least implicitly answer the question as to whether the commission can right now, with concededly no vacancy and a lawful holdover, appoint a new commissioner. I'm trying to think how you would, like, read the statute and not at least address that point. And that's – I agree there wasn't a lot of debate about that, but, you know, there might be – maybe you could say, if you're correct, there is no mandatory duty to appoint within a specific time frame. But in order to make sense of the statute, you know – can you only appoint if there's a vacancy, again, as the three Democratic appointees to the commission seem to say?
Yeah.
And to some extent, if this case is important for the functioning of the Elections Commission, perhaps it might be useful for us to at least interpret the statute in reference to that, too. It seems to be underneath the surface of this case.
Okay. You know, it might be useful in an advisory kind of way, sure, but in terms of necessary to decide the case, I'd push back on that.
Okay.
In Preen, it was necessary because if the governor didn't have an ability to appoint during a holdover, it brought up the problem the dissent was pointing out, which is, well, how do we ever even get someone that the Senate can look at, right? In this case, all the commission needs to do to create that vacancy that indisputably gives them the power to make an appointment is they remove a commissioner under 1561 1B2, which they can do at any time,
sure,
including the commissioner's term.
So you're, at this point, not taking a position at all as to whether the first sentence permits them, even absent a vacancy, to appoint a new administrator?
We just don't see it as necessary to reaching a holding in this case. So if I can get back to 1561, because understanding the statute is really helpful here in a kind of deeper level, that statute has the job of telling us who the appointing authority is for each of the commissioners and the administrator. And there's actually five different appointing authorities. It's a really interesting statute. Each position's term of office, the removal process for the administrator that I just talked about with Justice Hagedorn, and what to do if there's a vacancy either in a position of the commissioner or the administrator. And there are three sentences in 1561 that do impose a duty to appoint. But to respond to Justice Bradley's question, they all apply only if there's a vacancy. So you've got the third sentence of 1561.1b1, which talks about a vacancy in the position of the administrator, and then two sentences in 1561.5, which talk about vacancies in the commissioner positions. The provisions are pretty similar, but obviously we're going to focus on that third sentence of 1B1 today. Sorry, Justice Bradley.
I may just kind of tie this up, at least in my mind. I quoted earlier from the reply brief of the defendant appellants here, but in, and was asking about regardless if there's a vacancy. And I know that resonated in my ear because I had read it, and indeed it's on page 23, which you don't need to look at. I will read it to you of the legislature's brief. It says, here, under the plain text, statutory content, and statutory purpose of 1561, WEC must appoint an administrator at the expiration of each four-year term, regardless of whether a vacancy in that office exists. So it's your position, however, that you need a vacancy. So to that extent, you're at odds with whether
for sure.
a vacancy is needed. Let me ask, perhaps a bit rhetorically, are you asking us to overrule Prehn?
We are not. There's a lot of pieces of Prehn this court may want to revisit at some point, but that's not necessary today. We'll talk a little more about that as we go on. But what I want to focus on first is that third sentence of 1B1, because it has all the hallmarks of a statute that does create a duty, and I think it's really helpful to see what that kind of statute looks like. So we start that third sentence out, and it has a clause that creates the condition that triggers the vacancy. If a vacancy occurs. So now I'm on the commission. I'm like, oh, no, when this happens, right? Then I get to the second sentence. We've got an active voice sentence that says the commission shall appoint a new administrator. Well, right there, we know it doesn't apply to holdovers because you're not appointing a new administrator if you've got a holdover. Third, it creates a deadline to act, no later than 45 days after the date of the vacancy. And this one even has, like, the bonus round. The fourth sentence says that it creates a consequence if the commission fails to meet the deadline, turning things over to the Joint Committee on Legislative Organization, who appoints an interim administrator. Now, let's go back to the appellant's sentence that they like. It reads very differently, and it reads differently because it has a different job. And we know that our responsibility is to honor the different choices the legislature makes in drafting. And when they pick different language, especially in the same subsection of a statute, we respect it and give it different meaning. So let's look at that first sentence. Unlike the third sentence, it creates no triggering condition. It creates no deadline to make an appointment. It imposes no consequence for not making an appointment. And its syntactical structure, using the passive voice, then an appointee shall be chosen by the appointing authority, focuses on granting authority to the commission, not some other entity. If you go back to 1561.1a, you see all sorts of different bodies get to appoint. They are not bureaucrats. Two of them are actually appointed by two of the appellants here. But you have four different appointers up in for the commission, and we get down to the administrator, and the legislature said, the commission shall choose its own administrator, right? But the focus is on who has that grant of authority. It's like dozens of other provisions in our law. We think there's over 160 provisions like this in our statutes with that same syntax. Appointee shall be selected, shall be appointed by appointing authority.
Counsel, but how long could it go on, quite frankly? I mean, how long could she be a holdover? How long is indefinitely?
This is a question Justice Hagedorn asked during Prehn at oral argument. As long as the majority of the commission feels that she is doing a good job, and we'll talk in a minute about what a complex, difficult, full-time job this is, and as long as Administrator Wolf wants to continue carrying out this very intense job. But the important thing, and this is different than Prehn, is the appointing authority can remove her at any time if they feel that she's not doing a good job. This is not like the result in Prehn where the appointing authority was just stuck. Now, Mr. Saitlin mentioned that the passive voice just, I think his quote was, focuses the mind. And what passive voice can also do is focus our mind on what matters. And here what matters is who appoints, not imposing a duty on the commission.
Counsel,
and that's what this court concluded.
I know. I just want to go back to my previous question, because there are parts of your brief that discuss what the first sentence means in reference to Prane. But you discussed that Prane supports the rule that an appointing authority has the option but not a duty to make a new appointment during a holdover. And so there's a number of arguments here that, again, it's an option, not a duty. And so I thought the dispute between the two sides here was whether the first sentence mandated a new appointment within a particular period of time or whether it permitted a new appointment after, you know, the expiration of a term. But it seems to me that you're maybe backing away from that and saying there may or may not be the option to appoint if there's a vacancy, depending on the vacancy status. And again, I think that's why, to me, this question about whether you can appoint matters for how you read the statute. Does the statute give the commission the authority to appoint when there is no vacancy in subsection 1 or not? I don't know how we don't. I get your understanding. Your dream scenario is here. We just say the duty's not mandatory. You know, thank you. I understand that's your preferred argument here. But it feels like we have to read the statute, you know, in some ways. And your arguments, based on Prane in part, seem to suggest there is an authority to appoint somebody new again, which the three commissioners based their vote on the fact that they did not have any authority to act at all.
Right. And just to be clear, our friends on the other side have never made an argument that if they have an ability to appoint, they must, right? And I heard Your Honor saying, well, it would be good to give guidance to everybody on what the lay of the land is. So here would be the argument that they do have the ability to appoint. It's that the majority in Prane, not the dissent, said that 15.07, which is the governor's appointing authority, creates an option for him to appoint during a holdover. That's it, Prane at 23, 29, and 53,
right.
If it wants. So the analogy would be to say, well, you have that same passive syntax, you know, the person shall be appointed by the commission, so that if 15.07 has that role there, then 1561, the first sentence, does here. There are some differences in the statutes, obviously, including the fact that the governor's appointment statute gives for-cause protection to the person. So the whole sense of what the term of office is different there than it is in 1561, where the administrator never enjoys that for-cause protection. Mm-hmm. But I want to make sure we get to PASCO, because PASCO is really helpful to the court here, I think.
Before you do that, can I just ask you to respond to an argument that Mr. Zaitlin made, although he didn't make it today in front of us, but he made it numerous times in the briefs, that the sentence in paragraph 18, the governor must nominate and the Senate must confirm members of the DNR board, somehow infers this mandatory obligation.
So that paragraph is not talking about holdovers, Your Honor. It's just talking about the governor's general duty to appoint. If we want to find out what to do about holdovers, we got to go to those more specific sentences, paragraphs 23, 29, and 53.
Where it talks about prerogative.
Correct. And in the circuit court, they argued that prerogative means duty, that they must or that he must. I think they've abandoned that now. Okay, so let's make sure we get to PASCO here, because it again featured one of those common passive voice constructions. All vacancies in the department shall be filled and all new appointments shall be made by the respective chiefs. And the argument there was, hey, that creates a duty to appoint. And this court concluded in a unanimous opinion that the sentence shows that the legislature has merely designated who has authority to fill the vacancies, who has the power. It is not a mandate to the chief, but a grant of power. And the same is true with the first sentence of 1561-1B1. It is a grant of power to the appointing authority, here the commission, and other statutes, other appointing authorities. It is not a duty to appoint. Now, in their reply brief, the appellants tried to distinguish PASCO based on the premise that it did not have a temporal element. And I think the way Mr. Zaitlin described it today is it meant that our statute mentions a term of year. But the question isn't whether a statute talks about time ever. It's whether the statute has a deadline. In paragraph 28 of PASCO, you'll see that the statute says the statute did not require the chief to fill these positions at any certain time. Today, Mr. Stateland conceded that if the statute they're relying on does not require the commission to fill these positions on any particular deadline, and that's fatal. If there's no deadline, there's no duty. When the legislature wants to create a deadline, it's easy. You create deadline language. You require action within a certain time or no later than a certain number of days. That's exactly what they chose in the third sentence of 1B1, where they said not later than 45 days. And we all know that not every mention of time in a statute is a deadline, that time has many, many rules in our law. And telling appointing authorities and potential appointees what the term of office will be is a separate reason to discuss time. It doesn't have a secret embedded deadline within it.
Ms. Attorney Gibson, you seem to have a very well thought out outline, and I don't want you to have to stray too far from it, but I want to make sure you get to remedy at some point. So is that on your deadline? Because I am concerned with the remedy that you're requesting.
Sure. So in the, and I'm sure the court has reviewed the record thoroughly and sees the kind of struggles we had in the circuit court, the concessions they made in their litigation filings, but then the public comments they made in public. So we did seek injunctive relief there to make sure that those concessions, had some weight, and that the Senate didn't try to do what it had done in September of 23. We are confident that when this court rules that Administrator Wolf is validly holding over and that the commission has no duty to appoint during that holdover, that the appellants will respect that. So we are not seeking to continue the permanent injunction. In
just a declaratory judgment?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Correct.
And mandamus you're seeking. Yeah.
Right. I mean, we're so far from mandamus, and I don't even hear Mr. Stateland really trying to defend a mandamus statement. He's saying there's no specifics on when this duty even happens or how. We can't be in mandamus land, which requires a clear and plain duty.
Counsel, what work, if any, does the four-year term language in the statute do? Because it seems to me that there is absolutely no difference between an administrator during her four-year term or as a holdover. So doesn't your construction of the statute just read the four-year term language completely out of the statute?
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor. First of all, the term of office is different, has different roles in different statutes. So if we go back to the statute at issue in Prain, everybody on the court then agreed that during those 4 years after his Senate confirmation, he had for-cause protection. So that the term of office had that role for him. Here, in 1561, it never has that role because the administrator is always an at-will employee. So we have to look for other purposes for the term of office before we ever start talking about holdovers. And what that role is, as I may have mentioned before, is to provide both the appointing authority and the potential appointees a sense of what kind of job is this? And if we look at all these dozens of statutes with different terms, we see ones with really short terms and ones with long terms. Commissioners serve for 5 years, for example. And so longer terms come with a set of higher expectations about the goals we might set, the goals we might meet, and then the importance of continuity and stability in the position.
But if she's at will, it doesn't matter if she's serving her four-year term or she's a holdover.
No, it does not. But again, embedded in Your Honor's question is this idea that it's really like it must be an opportunity to reappoint or it must be an opportunity to fire.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just asking you, what role does it play? Because you could erase it from the statute, and your construction of the statute effectively erases it. There's no point in specifying a term for her because the commission could remove her at any point in time. She's an at-will employee. So my question again is, what role does the four-year term language serve? I don't think it serves any.
Well, I disagree with Your Honor, and I see okay. I'm not selling you on what we think is an important term. Maybe a helpful analogy is, often private contracts between independent contractors and companies will say, this is a 3-year contract, even though it's terminable at will by either side, right?
Well, a three-year contract between contract, if somebody hires a contractor, they have a contract. So if they try to terminate that, they have to have a reason. But here the commission does not.
No, that's not true, Your Honor.
Well, it is actually true, counsel, in a commercial context that you're invoking, which is not the same situation.
Well, we're outside the record now, but my personal experience is that you can have a term of a contract that remains terminable at will. And it is really important for people to understand what the initial term is, because we need to know, like, am I only going to be in town for 6 months? So I'd like to help out at the Wisconsin Elections Commission, but I really don't have that length of time to commit, right?
Why isn't the answer to your...
I'm
not getting an answer. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, maybe this will answer it. Why isn't the answer to Justice Rebecca Bradley's question, look at Prane? I mean, isn't that when Justice Dallet in her dissent in Prane talked about the conclusion being bizarre and absurd, and I think there might have been one other adjective that's not coming. Yeah, I'm sure there was. maybe even an adverb for one of those adjectives, absurdly bizarre. But when she wrote that in Prane, she's talking about this, right? Like in Prane, there was a 6-year staggered term. And we said, don't worry about it. So why isn't the answer to your question to Justice Bradley today, it's in Prane. I mean, Prane did away with that. It did away with what the end of a term means. That's what makes Prane so absurdly bizarre, right?
Well, I agree. I think that Mr. Stateland's side has said, well, it was meaningless under Prane, except that for the first time the governor has an opportunity to appoint if he wishes. But it doesn't have that role in this statute because the commission can always remove an administrator and pick someone new. And that's why we think it's a very crabbed reading of term of office to just see it as how soon can we fire you. I want to make sure we talk briefly about appellant separation of powers argument. I think everyone's probably on the same page on this, but unlike the U.S. Constitution, our Wisconsin Constitution has no constitutional role for the Senate to advise and consent. What they have is a statutory power. So if we comply with the statute, that's the end of the story. And I'd like to add, this would not be a great case to for the first time, recognize such an implied constitutional power for the Senate, because this isn't like Prane, where you had the governor that the Senate majority was just stuck with this guy who's appointing people maybe they don't like. They have a robust, significant role in picking who the appointing authority is to begin with. As I said, two of the appellants in this case picked two of the commissioners themselves, one of whom is actually a holdover. And then two more of the people are chosen by the governor, but from a three-person list given to them by legislative leadership, and then those two people go through advice and consent themselves.
Your opposing counsel has said he's not making a separate constitutional argument, that his argument is based upon the statute. So it seems to me that we're all in agreement, between the two of you at least, that the question before us is a statutory one.
Right. Great. It's great to have everyone on the same page.
We always are.
So I also wanted to address Mr. Stateland's point about a tie. And it is true that in some cases, the commissioners could sometimes disagree about the quality of an administrator's performance, and that means there wouldn't be a majority at that moment under 1B2. And we think that's a feature that the legislature wanted to build in here. They chose to have an even number of commissioners, not an odd number like this body, and that the commissioners reflect a variety of different viewpoints, even beyond the Democratic-Republican thing, right? Two of the commissioners must be former clerks. And so that means, and I know there are people in this room who get frustrated with them for tying for other reasons, but that reflects a preference in close cases for stability and consistency over acting potentially precipitously or in response to shifting political pressures. This role is not a part-time policy-making position like the NR board people. This is an intense, full-time job requiring expertise and experience. And it just doesn't work if there are frequent changes in personnel and sudden vacancies. And Administrator Wolf's responsibilities are detailed in the record at R6, and it's quite an overwhelming list. I'd urge you not to apply. But I thought it'd be helpful to get a flavor of some of the things she does. implement the directives of the Commission regarding elections administration, administering personnel and HR functions, preparing the standard ballot forms that all the clerks have to use, managing election recounts, administering recall elections, preparing guidance and advisory opinions issued that the Commission wants to issue, providing trainings for clerks and other election officials, creating voter information and education programs, and leading the agency's review and approval of electronic voting equipment, which you have to do before every election. That's just a sampling of the responsibilities, but if an administrator is underperforming, the Commission's right there on the ground with her. They're going to see that, and regardless of whether they're Republicans or Democrats, they're going to coalesce and bring in an administrator who can do the job. So if there are no further questions from the court, we ask this court to affirm the circuit court's holding below, that Administrator Wolf is validly holding over, and that the Commission has no duty to appoint during that holdover. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob?
Just a couple of brief points, Your Honor. I think the most telling portion of that presentation was my friend's answer to Justice Protasiewicz of how long can this go on. The answer was, I think I heard, forever. We have a situation where the position that they're putting forward is that three members of a commission can forever keep away from the people's voice.
You asked us to overrule Prain. Would that still be the case?
No, Your Honor. In Prain, you have a traditional deadlock between the governor and the legislature, which are both elected by the people. The way that that is resolved is the way that Prain resolves it. What we have here...
That's not answering my question.
Yes?
What I hear you say is what you said on page 35 of your brief, and you said, this creates an absurd separation of powers This creates the absurd separation of powers violating results discussed above, where the administrator will retain power indefinitely and with the support of exclusively one political party. And my question to you is, if you are sincerely worried about this, then why not ask us to overrule Prain?
I mean, you've read the dissent, right? It's convincing.
No, it's not.
I would submit that there's a very significant difference when you have the governor, who's elected by the people to be the chief executive, deadlocked with the Senate, which is elected by the people to do advice and consent, versus a situation where you have three, with respect, bureaucrats holding this, the state's chief election officer's appointment away from all the people.
But that wasn't the basis of Prain. It wasn't based on who made the appointments and that it was a deadlock between the governor and the legislature. Where do you see any of that language? That's not even in the dissent.
I mean, I wasn't involved in Prain, but as I read the Prain decision, there was a prior decision of this court, Thompson, and the majority, an old case, the majority went with Thompson. The dissent wanted to overrule Thompson. You know, stare decisis is an important consideration. None of that is at issue here. We have a statute that has certain language, has mandatory language. And we have the Council for WEC saying that this absurd position can go on forever. There's no precedent that requires this court to reach that absolutely absurd result. They cite PASCO. The PASCO didn't have any sort of term of years in there. If you read the statute of PASCO, it's obviously just telling the Milwaukee folks who appoints. Here, you have a four-year term, and it says shall. By far the most reasonable reading of that is that once that four-year term expires, these folks on WEC have to make the appointment so that the people, I mean, look, there's a lot of arguments here. We've got to take a step back. This is the state's chief election officer. They are telling this court that who the state's chief election officer will be forever away from the people. That is not a sustainable result in a democracy.
Counsel,
go ahead.
If you're suppose the commission had appointed a new administrator that was rejected by the Senate. In your read of the statute, would it require the commission to act again?
I think that's right, Your Honor. The second section of the provision we're talking about, second sentence, says that once the nomination has been sent over, then WEC appoints an interim administrator during the period of the Senate's consideration. If Administrator Wolf or somebody else was sent over and the nomination was rejected, that interim administrator presumably would stay on as a holdover until WEC did its duty to send over another name, and eventually there would be an agreement, because it's so important to have a chief election officer. The problem with the interpretation... Sorry, Your
Honor. I just want to follow up with one question your opposing counsel made, and I'd like to hear you respond to it. That your argument is that they need to do it within a reasonable time. You don't argue that there's a specific deadline for it. And our argument is under mandamus that puts us kind of outside of mandamus because it's not a sufficiently certain piece. Would you respond to that argument, please?
I mean, Your Honor, mandamus is an equitable remedy. You know, the closest case we found on point to a situation like this is the Hanasuba case out of Hawaii. The Hawaii Supreme Court ordered the mandamus, and they said, you got a reasonable time to do this. I mean, that's the way mandamus generally works. You got to give the officials a reasonable time. You can't appoint them back in July. You got to do it now. I mean, whatever that reasonable time period is, it's been a year and a half. And look, Your Honors, if you think that we haven't satisfied the standards for mandamus, issue a ruling saying that we're right on the meaning of the statute. Presumably, you know, the kind of, frankly, nonsense that's been going on with WEC, where they're saying we're not going to send anyone over unless you pre-commit to approving it, would end if there was that kind of decision. Otherwise, we'd spend a year and a half. It's been a year and a half since the people have a statutory right to speak who will be their chief election officer. If this case comes out the way that the circuit court ruled, it will be indefinitely. And that is just not a sustainable way to govern a democracy.
Thank you. All right. The court is adjourned. Oral argument. The students that are here, we hope to see you again about noon. And other than that, go about and enjoy your day.